What is possible is that President Xi and President Trump will meet somewhere.
But the talks aimed at U.S.-China trade will not take place in Chile as planned. This is Thursday, the 31st of October, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, today is the day official changes might become reality in Kashmir and Jammu. Personal struggles in Myanmar, these dealing with drugs. And we'll take you to a U.S. Halloween parade. It is all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump had planned to meet with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the APEC gathering in Santiago, Chile next month. The meeting, many said, was to possibly announce some sort of deal on U.S.-China trade. White House Bureau Chief for VOA Steve Herman is with us. Set, what happened, Steve?
Well, what we know, Ira, is there's not going to be a meeting between President Trump and President Xi in Santiago next month, and that's because of the announcement by the Chilean President Sebastián Piñera that the APEC summit, the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting, is not going to be held there because of the situation on the ground in Santiago, where there's been an anti-government protest going on for some weeks and has been violent at times. So if they are going to meet, it's going to be somewhere else.
Has there been any notification from the White House, or at least any indication from the White House what might happen next?
Well, the White House was caught by surprise that the APEC summit was being canceled. There's not a secondary site prepared. The White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley, who I spoke to a couple of times today, said that the administration's awaiting potential information regarding another location. And he said that the White House is still looking forward to finalizing what the president's called phase one of what would be, in the views of the president, a historic trade deal with China within the same time frame. And he says, when we have an announcement, we'll let you know. So everything basically is up in the air right now.
Do you think there is any way that those involved can find a secondary gathering for this meeting, which had been postponed anyway? It was originally scheduled for Brazil, and it was moved to Chile.
Right. It's looking like it's a very low possibility that we're going to see an APEC summit next month. What is possible is that President Xi and President Trump will meet somewhere. The APEC summit was ideal because this would take place on the sidelines. It's a neutral turf. It's not President Xi coming to the U.S. or President Trump going to China. And we could see something like we viewed a couple of times with President Trump and the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, where they met in a third country. But that was a more elaborate event. We're not expecting anything quite that elaborate because it appears that the Chinese weren't looking to make a huge deal out of signing a partial trade agreement. But one thing we've seen, Ira, in this White House, things can change very quickly. The president can be impulsive. I'm talking about the U.S. president, and could get on the phone with President Xi and work something out on short notice.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman joined us via Skype. Thank you, Steve. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top stories and headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Tokyo's governor insists she still wants to see the Olympic marathon held in the capital next year, despite plans to move the event to northern Japan over concerns about heat. banks in Malaysia are closing the accounts of Iranian individuals and companies. Nearly a dozen affected, people told Reuters, in a sign that U.S. sanctions are having a far-reaching impact on citizens of the Islamic Republic. Rescuers in Japan have been searching for a man who appears to have fallen down part of Mount Fuji as he was live streaming his climb up the country's highest peak. The body has been recovered. Identification procedures are underway. This is VOA Asia. India will formally split up occupied Jammu and Kashmir into two federal territories today. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist government withdrew occupied Kashmir's autonomy in August, but in addition, it also announced its division into two territories to be directly ruled from New Delhi, one consisting of Jammu and Kashmir, the other the remote Buddhist enclave of Ladakh. Joining us on VOA Asia to talk about this is Sumit Ganguly, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Indiana University. Professor, can you explain what these separations mean for the countries involved and the people who live there?
Well, to begin with, it ends Kashmir's special status in the Indian Union. Under something called Article 370, Kashmir had a separate constitution. It had its own legislative assembly, and there were a whole series of other provisions of the Indian constitution that did not apply to Kashmir. All this has been stripped away in one fell swoop. Now the question is how the Supreme Court will decide, and in fact, I think the decision is almost imminent.
When you say almost imminent, could it come out today? Could this wipe this away by a decision of the court on this day? Or do you expect a little lag?
The court merely has to affirm or deny the decision. And the court has the power to actually deny the decision because the decision to revoke Kashmir's special status had been challenged in court, and it remains to be seen how this panel of judges of the Supreme Court comes down, whether they are persuaded by the government's argument or the arguments of those who are aggrieved.
And what's your prediction on this?
The Supreme Court is not predictable. On occasion, the Supreme Court supports the government. On occasion, even in contentious issues, it has ruled against the government. So, and this is such a fraught issue. People will be watching this with, you know, much anticipation in New Delhi and in other regional capitals, most notably in Pakistan.
Are you telling me now that the separation has not officially been implemented? And if not, why is there so much violence there? But there has been violence there for decades now. But nevertheless, it seems like there is increased violence.
Well, since the decision of early August, there has not been substantial violence, largely because there has been a military clampdown in the state. There is a enhanced paramilitary and army presence in the state, and much of economic life has come to a standstill. There have been a few sporadic attacks, but nothing of any significance. But India cannot sustain this level of military presence indefinitely. And furthermore, normal commerce, normal trade will have to be resumed. And that has not happened since the decision of early August. And so matters are really in quite a disturbed state in the entire region.
What has life been like for people there?
Everyday life is extremely hard because there are significant limitations on movement. Many shopkeepers, as a form of protest, are keeping their shops closed. While landlines have been restored, to the best of my knowledge, the internet has not been restored, and consequently, this is causing considerable hardship for the population. And I think only a limited number of cell phone towers have been reactivated. So even cell phone coverage is rather constricted at the moment.
What happens today when officially this goes into effect? Will that mean any change as far as their lives are concerned or how the regions are governed?
Well, much depends on how the decision comes down. If the decision is in favor of the government, I suspect there will be further unrest in the state. There will be greater unhappiness, particularly in the Kashmir Valley, where the grievances are the most pronounced. In other parts of Kashmir, there could be rejoicing in Jammu, for example, or in the northern region of Kashmir in Ladakh, where the move actually has been welcomed. But the heart of the contention really lies in Kashmir, in the Kashmir Valley, and that's where we may witness further unhappiness, grievances coming to the fore, and then, of course, new political arrangements over the next several months will have to be worked out, where Ladakh would not have an assembly, but Jammu and Kashmir would have an assembly. It remains to be seen how elections would be conducted. We are really in uncharted territory at the moment.
Can these moves change relationships that India has, or Pakistan has for that matter, with China, Russia, the United States, other countries with whom they have dealings?
Not with the vast majority of the countries that you mentioned, but India's view is if it can successfully pull off the measure that it has undertaken and can restore some semblance of normalcy in the region, then effectively the dispute with Pakistan is over, and that would free India up to concentrate on its northern border with China, which is the subject of a substantial border dispute harking back to the 1950s. But much is hinged upon India's ability to bring about some semblance of normalcy with the in the region, which it has sought to integrate into India more fully. If it can actually do that, then for all practical purposes, the Indo-Pakistani dispute will have come to an end. One may not care for the manner in which this has been carried out, but I think that's the strategic logic underlying this decision.
Dr. Shyamal Ganguly via Skype from the University of Indiana in Bloomington. Happening now in Asia, at least 5 children have died, 17 others injured Wednesday after a gas cylinder used to inflate balloons exploded outside of a school in Bangladesh's capital. The local police chief said the explosion took place when a vendor was selling balloons to children who live in a nearby slum in Dhaka. He said the cylinder was placed on a tricycle rickshaw when the explosion happened. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. In Myanmar's Kachin State, 8 years of conflict and displacement have caused some civilians to turn to drugs as authorities struggle to control and rehabilitate heroin and amphetamine addicts, both in the refugee camps and cities across the state. Users and officials tell of the struggles both on and off the battlefield. Steve Sanford filed this report for VOA.
Here in Kachin State's biggest IDP camp, economic instability and the hardships of war have left some civilians turning to drugs as a coping mechanism. For those working outside the camps, a rise in drug production that has been linked to organized crime and armed groups, including Myanmar government forces, have kept camp officials busy enforcing the law.
We lived in the IDP camp near the China border, and there are many drug dealers and users along the border. When we hear people in the IDP camps are addicted to drugs, we will investigate and find out who is using. We will have the leaders of that section in the camp find the person and take them to a rehab center.
At a nearby clinic run by the anti-drug vigilante group Pachisan, many of the addicts become drug dependent to offset laborious jobs demanding long hours. Jade mining in Kachin State generates big revenue, and cheap heroin is readily available for miners like Lata.
I only use drugs while I'm working at the jade mine and searching for jade. I don't take drugs all the time like the other people do. It's only when I'm working. I took heroin when I was with friends, and then I realized I was addicted to the drug.
Some of the addicts have reoccurring bouts with the drugs and are forced to revisit the centers where treatment includes religious lectures and physical discipline. Seng Nupan's mother had to shut down their market stall when the fighting spread in 2011. So Nupan began selling drugs to help feed the family.
I have so many friends, and they beg me to help them to find the drugs. I help them to buy drugs from our township and bring it back to the community. That's why I started taking drugs from this point.
As many political roadblocks remain on Myanmar's road to peace, observers expect the drug trade to continue unabated. Steve Sanford for VOA News.
Stay with us. Coming up, why did the U.S. leave some troops in Syria to guard Syrian oil? This is VOA Asia.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A court in Myanmar on Wednesday sentenced five members of a traditional theatrical troupe to a year in prison for their jibes about the military. The members of the Peacock Generation troupe were arrested in April for performances during celebrations of Myanmar's traditional New Year, where they poked fun at officials. This is VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump has made protecting Syria's oil reserves a top priority and is deploying U.S. troops to the oil fields, even as he pulled American forces out of the border area with Turkey, clearing the way for a Turkish military assault earlier this month on the Kurds. Senior administration officials say the U.S. wants to keep the oil fields from falling back into the hands of Islamic State militants. But as VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sane reports, experts are questioning Trump's focus on the oil fields.
These images of angry Kurds reacting to being abandoned by U.S. forces in Syria underscored the widespread criticism of President Donald Trump's decision to withdraw American soldiers in the face of a Turkish incursion. But now the president wants American troops deployed to protect the oil fields in eastern Syria.
The oil is, so valuable for many reasons. It fueled ISIS, number one. Number two, it helps the Kurds, because it's basically been taken away from the Kurds. They were able to live with that oil. And number three, it can help us, because we should be able to take some also. And what I intend to do, perhaps, is make a deal with an ExxonMobil or one of our great companies to go in there and do it properly.
Defense Secretary Esper further explained the reasoning.
We are now taking some actions, I'm not going to get into the details, to strengthen our position at Dar Azar, to ensure that we can deny ISIS access to the oil fields, because we want to make sure that they don't have access to the resources that may allow them to strike within the region, to strike Europe, to strike the United States.
Islamic State militants depended on the oil a few years ago, say experts.
When ISIS was controlling a lot of territory in Syria and Iraq, it used the oil fields to its benefit, both to fuel its military operations, literally put oil in its trucks, in its cars, in its vehicles, etc., but also smuggled enormous quantities of oil onto the black market.
But most experts dismiss the idea that American companies could make use of Syria's oil.
American oil companies would face a host of practical difficulties in operating there, legal difficulties, practical challenges. So this would not be easy to do, and I'm not sure they would be actually eager to do it.
Jeff Colgan told VOA that terrorists, going back at least to Osama bin Laden, have often falsely claimed that America is only involved in the Middle East so it can take the oil away from countries in the region.
This kind of comment and suggestion from President Trump feeds that narrative, and it really works against the safety, the long-term safety of United States citizens to have that kind of narrative legitimated in the Middle East.
President Trump, Laurie Blank says, is fixated on the oil because of an outdated concept of war.
That interest seems to, at least in my mind, be based on a very ancient conception of war that doesn't exist anymore, which is the idea of conquest. You know, that you go, you conquer, you take. And the world doesn't work that way anymore.
With so many actors involved in the Syrian conflict, Russians, Kurds, Syrian troops, and even Iranian fighters, experts say control of the oil fields is likely to be contested. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
This news break from VOA Asia, an upstate New York orchestra reversed course Tuesday and canceled plans to tour China this winter after China refused to allow the group's three South Korean musicians to perform. The Eastman Philharmonia from the University of Rochester's Eastman School of Music initially said they would go, but changed their minds late Tuesday, saying they would postpone until everyone could go. On Halloween, the spookiest day of the year, on October 31st, it is traditional for children in the United States to wear costumes to go trick-or-treating in their neighborhoods to ask for candy. Some communities also have Halloween parades. Earlier this week, characters like pirates, angels, and scarecrows marched in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside Washington. VOA's Deborah Block takes us along the colorful parade with some imaginative costumes.
These Virginia homes brim with the fun-loving spirit of Halloween, decorated with scary clowns.
That's it. Come closer.
Not-so-scary pumpkins, and other things just hanging around. Before the big trick-or-treating day, the community held its annual Halloween parade. Former Alexandria Mayor Allison Silberberg helped judge the best pet costume contest.
The Delray Halloween Parade is an annual tradition that we all love, and there are kids of all ages in costume, and it is absolutely hilarious to see what people come up with.
I am Old Bay Seasoning, a classic American seafood seasoning from Baltimore, Maryland. I have with me a lobster/crab family and a chef for a wife. So we've got the dog, very tasty crab lobster, and a little two-month-old. You can season her up a little bit.
Yep, she's not too happy right now. She's very crabby.
This group's float with people holding umbrellas had a more serious message on protecting the world's oceans.
It's very important that we pay attention to our oceans and our children realize what we need to do with them.
This pirate liked the original costumes.
It's not the sort of typical American thing where everything's just sort of store purchased. These families have spent hours and hours putting together costumes and hand painting them and hand building them.
This woman who dressed as a bird used a variety of materials to make her one-of-a-kind crow costume.
Coat hangers and a bicycle helmet and paper mache and ping pong balls and Christmas ornaments.
The spectacle thrilled bystanders.
I like all the costumes.
This is just a wonderful tradition that makes Delray a really special place to live.
14-year-old Mackenzie Metzner and her family won a top prize for their video game characters.
It's very exciting because we've been trying to win for 3 years now.
Apparently, this Wonder Woman dog does more than lay down looking pretty.
Well, the superheroes have captured the villains. We've got the Riddler, the Joker, Poison Ivy, and Catwoman. Have been captured by Batman, Robin, and Wonder Woman.
Some of the characters sure to be seen trick-or-treating in the Delray neighborhood on creepy yet festive Halloween night. Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
Thank you for listening to us at VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, take VOA Asia with you, and visit our voanews.com program page. See us on YouTube, follow us on VOA Asia Twitter, and let's hear from you on VOA Asia Facebook, as well as our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Nelson Lopes, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. Have a fine day ahead.